Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Art Sear, Craig Capstein, and Robert Pape. Our program tonight coming to you from the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Nice to have you with us. 1-800-723-8289 is our address, our phone number. 1-800-723-8289 if you'd like to join us. Send us an email. It's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, tonight for the next 2 hours, we're going to be talking about an issue that has become front and center on U.S. foreign policy, and that is the threatening rhetoric and the actions of what's happening in North Korea, how it affects South Korea, how it affects the United States, because there is a leader out there who is shaking the nuclear rattling the sabers, if you will. And tonight we're going to take a serious look at Korea, North and South, what it means for us, what it means for the future, and how crazy is this new leader of North Korea. Bob Pape, we thank you very much for joining us tonight, one of the country's leading experts on military power from the University of Chicago. I want to talk a little bit more about your expertise as the program unfolds this evening. But again, as you look at this North Korean, the rhetoric and the actions that have been taken place over the last couple of months, where do you put it on the fear level?
Well, until Friday, I would have put it pretty low on the fear level. We have been through a number of kind of pseudo-crises with North Korea over the last 20 years, of course, some extending all the way back to the 1950s. But the fact is, those pseudo-crises over the last 20 years have typically been where North Koreans haven't done anything militarily, even moved military equipment. In the last few days, the thing that's most worrisome is that they have moved one of their nuclear-capable missiles, the Musudan missile, to its firing station in the east of the country. And then on top of that, they issued a warning to our embassies in Pyongyang, that's the capital of North Korea, saying they could not guarantee their safety after April 10th. The combination of those two events raises us from a pretty minor, normal pseudo-crisis to the beginnings of a real problem.
Craig Capstein also joins us. He is a captain in the United States Naval Reserve, retired, spent some time in Korea during your 28 years service to the United States. Where do you put North Korea and how real this threat is?
Let's put it this way. Each time we have a change of command at the top in North Korea, what we have is 6 to 8 weeks later, there's a military episode, the sinking of a ship, the rocketing of a facility, the killing of people, the movement of a small submarine, things on that order. So there's always a display to give the new leader an opportunity to shine. By the way, I think the warnings to embassies in Pyongyang were actually warnings to other embassies. I'm not sure we have one there. I don't think
when
do.
I said our, I meant Western embassies, including. Right. So I did not mean America. I mean, the United States doesn't have diplomatic relations.
Well, the British.
The Swedish represented.
The key thing that you have is the big question. Do we have one issue or another? Do we have the macro or the micro issue? The macro being, is this simply China redirecting the activities to a degree of North Korea and its new leader to really take the focus of the United States and Western powers?
Is it on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you put it, with 10 being a maximum threat?
I'd say we're at a 7 right now.
A 7 right now. Art Sear from Carthage College also joins us, the A.W. Clawson professor. Art, where do you put it on the scale of threats? I think a couple of weeks ago you said it was the most troubling spot in the world, you thought. And that was 2 weeks ago.
It's currently the flashpoint. It's an area where we might well have a nuclear war. I've felt since before the Cold War ended that there was a possibility of a nuclear war in the world, but it probably wouldn't directly involve any of the major powers.
And what is likely to trigger that action, Art?
I don't think there will be a war, mind you. I do think Craig makes a good point that apocalyptic rhetoric, and also some military action has characterized this totalitarian regime. What we have now is a particularly young, particularly immature leader. We also might well have a power struggle going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely.
My op-ed this week emphasized they've actually been extremely erratic now for a few years, which implies nobody's in charge. We don't know what's going on internally.
But Kim Jong-un's military people, didn't he get recently moved aside?
There are rumors and innuendo that about a half a dozen top generals have simply disappeared, including a General Ri, who was removed abruptly last July, arguably for health reasons, but that nobody believes that. Several people who used to be fairly visible are gone. But again, we don't know, and I emphasize that because the modern media, not this program, but emphasizes so much hysteria, passes off speculation as news. Serious people should be extremely careful about what you conclude regarding North Korea because we don't know.
I also want to add, this is not a one-sided game. This is a two-sided game. And how we have reached this point is a product, I think, of careless behavior, not just on the part of the North Koreans, but also on the part of the Obama administration, and I think the diplomacy with the Chinese. How we got here, Bruce, is that North Korea did a nuclear test on early February, February 11th. That is their third nuclear test over the last few years. We responded to that.
And South Korea thinks they're going to have another one on April 10th.
Well, they may another event such as a test may well occur. But what happened is we decided, that is the Obama administration, to slap economic sanctions on North Korea to punish them for this test. We worked with China to slap these sanctions on. Well, actually, we've had sanctions on North Korea now for many, many years. We had to actually look quite hard to find anything to sanction. But nonetheless, we did. And this put the new leader of North Korea in a particular bind because the new leader has just taken office, as Craig said, and of course he has a credibility problem just because he's new.
He wasn't even supposed to be the leader; his brother was supposed to get the job.
And so what the Obama administration did is they put this new young leader in this bind, and this regime has already been a little bit idiosyncratic, shall we say, by slapping sanctions on and essentially threatening his credibility, this has put this young leader in a position to essentially have to stand up.
So they have, with their rhetoric and their actions, I'm talking about the Obama administration, they may have backed this guy into a corner, given him no off-ramp?
I think they've given him, not only did they initially back him in a corner with the economic sanctions, but then in response to the rhetoric, which actually has happened numerous times, North Korea has responded to our imposition of rounds of sanctions with very identical rhetoric to this numerous times. The Obama administration is the first one to move military aircraft. They first flew nuclear-capable B-52s over South Korea, saying that this was to extend our nuclear deterrent over the South. Then we flew B-2s over, basically planning bombing runs, bombing runs over the North. Well, this is further back
not
the North
over
Korean
North
leader.
Korea, in, I don't think.
Well, no, it's not. We flew them over the South, but they were in on their route as if they were going
we've
to
got,
bomb.
Gentlemen, we've got to pause.
An act of war.
There's a lot of that. We've a lot of information. Continue the conversation in a moment. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us tonight from coast to coast and border to border. And again, if you just tuned in, we're talking about North Korea, and we'll also be talking about South Korea. And obviously, for the last several weeks, there's been a lot of saber rattling on the part of the North. And tonight, what we're trying to give you is as much background information on that region of the world. It's a region of the world that has exploded in war before, or conflict, the Korean conflict of the 1950s. We're going to be talking about that as the program unfolds as well. But let's talk a little bit more about this new leader, Kim Jong-un. Tell us what you know about him, some of which you've obviously read. And you said something in the last segment that I want to follow up on. He basically pushed his brother out of the way to get the top job. Why did the brother fail?
The brother failed because he used a a doctored passport and went to Japan to try the Japanese version of Disney or whatever. Unfortunately, he got caught on that act.
Because he was going to a theme park?
Because he was doing theme park stuff, yes, absolutely. It embarrassed the country greatly. You can't imagine what that does
to
a culture.
He's the oldest son. The eldest son.
Yes. He was next in line to take over from Kim Jong-il, the father. So Kim Jong-un, the present leader, was selected down, the deep selected, we'll call it in Navy terms. And he is a person that went to college in Switzerland. Only he masqueraded as the, for his own safety, I might add, as the son of the chauffeur of the North Korean embassy. And either of the other two gentlemen can take it from there if you'd like.
But we also know that he's fixated with Dennis Rodman.
Oh, yes. He likes Dennis Rodman very much.
Well, here's what's bothering me.
But he's not really aware of the U.S. military or the South Korean military.
How strong a military and how strong an army is North Korea, Bob?
Very, very weak. Very, very weak. Our image of North Korea, to the extent we have an image, often goes back to the Korean War, where North Korea was a force to be reckoned with. The fact is, today, North Korea has some paper strength. They have some numbers on paper. But let me just give you some important facts. The North Korean GDP is $40 billion a year. $40 billion, to put it in context, is less than half of Cleveland. So if you compare this to South Korea, South Korea's GDP is $1.5 trillion,
and it's
more than 25 times the size of North Korea's GDP. If you look at their military, so as you know, I study air power, the South Koreans have a cutting edge, leading edge, not quite as good as our Air Force, but a leading edge modern precision Air Force. They have hundreds of F-15, F-16s that can drop precision guided missile munitions. The North Koreans are still operating with 1950s technology. And this is not just true in their Air Force. This is true in their
Army,
to, et cetera, et cetera.
To cut to the chase here is, if there was a war, I don't want to talk about nuclear war right now. I want to talk about a conventional war. If there was a conventional war between the North and the South, based on your expertise, and you're one of the leading experts in the world on air power and military power, this would be no contest, almost no contest.
This would be no contest, with the exception that the North Koreans could bloody the South and possibly others in a way that we haven't really seen in the last 20 years.
So the only way, one follow-up in this, the only way for Kim Jong-un to really compete is to forget the conventional comparison of conventional war.
That's right.
And move to missiles.
Move to missiles and other ways to essentially kill civilians. So that the real issue that they have that they can threaten us with are a variety of means by which they can hurt civilians or our troops en masse, but not in a way that they could actually conquer Seoul or even stop the conquest of their own country. If there were a war, within weeks, I'd say 3 weeks, 4 weeks, North Korea would fall militarily. But during that period of time, there could be a lot of very, very costly bloodshed.
Art Sear, your comment.
Bob, I certainly agree with Bob's perspective. One of my favorite statements is armchair generals study battles, grand strategy, real generals study logistics and supply. They don't have supply lines. However, they do have a very powerful warrior tradition. At least a million people, including 35,000 good Americans, died in the Korean War. It was enormously bloody. It was sustained, intensive combat, unlike Vietnam, very much like the last year of the terrible war in Europe, 44-45. These people know how to fight. They're ferocious, and they could effectively destroy Seoul, which is a massive city. Don't underestimate the degree to which they could do conventional war damage.
A question for those young people listening to the program. Tell us about what started the Korean conflict.
Well, we know now from the archives, the Soviet archives, that Stalin, in effect, told Kim Il-sung, the original member of this dynastic family.
The grandfather of the current.
Yeah, and the Stalinist who led the revolution and set up the North Korean regime, but as a Soviet puppet. He launched the massive conventional invasion of the South in late June of 1950. President Truman, to his enduring credit, didn't wait for Congress to declare war. He followed a UN resolution as authority, and we intervened directly. We suffered devastating losses initially, then we were able to reverse course.
How did we engage? Was it air power? What did we do?
We were very limited in our use of air power until the end of the war. Right.
Troops from Japan.
I think of the Korean War, I think of troops. I think troops of the ground, very
right.
bloody,
divisions.
Very
we send divisions, divisions,
bodies of men just very, swarming
very,
in.
Very poorly trained American troops who'd been barracked in Japan and were living a very soft and luxurious life when the dollar made you a millionaire, were sent to Korea. Douglas MacArthur made a grand total of two or three photo op trips to Korea. He never stayed overnight there. For all these reasons, we were devastated initially. And then under Matthew Ridgway, especially after MacArthur was fired, we were able to reverse course. We drove all the way up to the northern tip of North Korea, and the Chinese intervened, as they said they would do, and the war reached a stalemate that went on for about 2 years at the 38th parallel.
More into the history. You mentioned MacArthur. There's a movie out about MacArthur right now. Why did Douglas MacArthur get fired?
Because he persisted in disagreeing publicly with the Truman administration.
But he wanted to escalate.
He wanted to go right into China, and he wanted to use nuclear weaponry on China, which came into the war.
He also
on the side of North Korea.
Okay, so he was the ultimate expansionist.
Yes, that let's say that he just wanted to erase China as a future problem for the United States. He didn't want to go in and occupy it and take it over or do anything like that.
And at the time, we were very fearful that then there would be a Soviet threat in Western Europe. So as this is unfolding on the Korean Peninsula, we have to remember these are the days of the Cold War where what's happening in Korea is linked, at least we're worried it might be linked, to what might happen in Western Europe and possibly elsewhere in the world. So we're worried the reason that MacArthur overreached it was so clearly was that even if he was right for Korea, there was a huge risk with going that far with what it would mean for our ability to hold Western Europe.
Greg?
It was a real backwater area for the United States. We wanted to make sure that Japan was protected. Our focus was on Europe. MacArthur actually refused Truman's order to come back to the United States for talks. And so Truman had to go out to Wake Island to meet with him. Amazing for a president to do that. But if we go back to this business of Seoul, you asked about what would the opportunities.
I guess why it's important to know the history. Uh-huh. I'm wondering whether the conditions that started the war in the 50s are upon us today.
I don't think so. It was an intelligence failure then. North Korea.
Intelligent failure by whom?
By the United States.
By the United States.
By the Western powers.
Does everyone agree with that assessment? Art, you look like you're shaking your head.
I would say it was.
And why don't you expand on that?
Well, quite frankly, I think the United States defocused on the area. After World War II, Russia came into the war only weeks before the war in the Pacific Theater. An agreement at what, Potsdam? Allowed them to come in and come down to the 30...
I think it was U.S. Yalta. I think it was
U.S.
Yalta,
military people drew a line at the 38th parallel and said, even though we aren't up there yet, we hope we can get up there by the time the Russians come down.
I guess the question I'm asking based on what you said, Bob, is with the tremendous difference between life in North Korea and life in South Korea, this tremendous success, why would they not at least attempt to make some sort of a strike on South Korea? If you think that they could really devastate the country, even if they lost, I mean, from a nationalist standpoint.
It would be national suicide. North Korea would be destroyed.
But that doesn't necessarily keep leaders from rolling
the
dice.
No, but the peace
right?
is held for 60 years, Bruce.
Yes,
we're
I
talking
know.
About the
right.
downside, but the peace is held for 60 years. Excuse
North,
me.
North Korea has had a major problem since the end of the Korean War, which is just simply staying in power and staying an independent country. Since 1953, when the war effectively ended, South Korea, because it's our ally and we've had enormous trade relations with South Korea, we've developed South Korea, South Korea has blossomed into one of the leading economies of the world.
The fourth largest economy in the Pacific.
It's extremely impressive. At the same time, North Korea is basically stuck in 1953. There really are very few changes that have occurred in that country. Now, it's true you can find a MacBook here or there on pictures and so forth, but effectively, Bruce, one country has blossomed enormously while the other has been frozen in time.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we do have callers standing by, but there's some lines open. Nice to hear from you. 1-800-723-8029. Back in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us. And now let me give you the phone number one more time. 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. I've received numerous emails saying that I give the phone number too fast, then I say 8289 and nobody can follow it. So it's 8289. 8289. 1-800-723-8289. So I will try to get into the new habit of giving it one number at a time, not running them together, trying to respond to those that have been kind enough to send me an email message. Bob Pate, Robert Pate is with us this evening. He's with the University of Chicago, and he is one of the country's leading experts on air power. Bombing to Win is mm-hmm. one of your books. Tell us a little bit more about the other books that you've written and your primary area of study.
For the last 20 years, I've spent a long time with air power. I've published Bombing to Win.
You went to Dartmouth.
I got my PhD from the University of Chicago. Then I spent several years teaching for the U.S. Air Force. I taught conventional targeting strategy for the U.S. Air Force for 3 years to some of the best pilots in the world. I taught at Dartmouth as well. Then I also taught, again, I'm now at the University of Chicago since 1999. I've also spent years studying the consequences of economic sanctions. And then, as you know from your program where you've had me on most recently, I've spent the last 10 years also studying terrorism, especially suicide terrorism.
And tell us about, we're going to come back to that because I want to get a report on to what extent is North Korea as a nation involved in mm-hmm. terrorism. Get back to that. But let me also...
They are the only...
I'm going to get back to that okay. in just a moment. Craig Kopstein also joins us. He is a captain of the United States Naval Reserve, retired. And tell us a little bit about you've had a distinguished career, 28 years. You were on the Desert Storm staff with General Norman Schwarzkopf. You were on his staff. But you also have spent some time in Korea. Tell us about your Korean experience.
Well, I participated in two of their biggest exercises, Team Spirit, which no longer they do. They've kind of morphed that into another one. And then not Ultra Focus Lens, but the current exercise that they're doing now, which is Full Eagle. They have three major exercises during the year. And what they do is the first one really gets the forces looked at, the estimates made, the logistics worked on and things on that order. Then the next several exercises put all the pieces together until we're working with maybe 400,000 to 500,000 South Koreans and probably up to 40,000 or 50,000 United States
and
troops.
And you have been to the DMZ.
I've been to the DMZ.
Describe
what
the DMZ
the
is like. That's the demilitarized zone. That is the area between south and north, and each side is looking at the other side with guns drawn and bullets in the chamber, right?
It is the toughest, most tense, most dangerous border anywhere in the world. Absolutely. The North Koreans play to kill. And if they don't shoot first, if somebody does an incursion or what they think is an incursion, they'll be killed by their own military.
And there's no sense of humor there.
There is little sense of humor. They have a monster-sized flag flying over across the border. They really keep their their border unique. In fact, one of the buildings is a little bitty thing, probably 10 feet wide, and it's made to look like a great big building. They have martial music that plays all the time, very loud. They light up the place at night. But the border itself is very tense all the way across North Korea.
Also with us this evening is Art Sear. Art Sear is the A.W. Clawson Professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin, author of the book After the Cold War. And we thank you all for joining us then. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Chris standing by in Palatine, Illinois on WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen. I understand that, you know, I've read anyway that North Korea has roughly 100,000 artillery tubes that are massed on the border between South Korea and Seoul, which is a city of maybe, what, 35, 38 million people or so, is about 20 miles away, give or take. If the North Koreans start firing, even with all of the, you know, counter-artillery and capabilities that they have in South Korean Army and the American Army, they're going to get off 10, maybe 20 rounds per tube, which is going to be maybe 2 million artillery shells raining down on a city of 35 million people. And, you know, one of your guests mentioned, well, then the South would get bloodied. Well, you know, you're talking millions of people dying and probably tens of millions of people being horribly injured. I don't consider that, you know, being bloodied. It's bloodied as a bloody nose or a black eye, you know, or a split lip. You know, we're talking about massive death, and I think what we need to do is be a hell of a lot less bellicose and saying, beating our hairy chests and saying, yeah, we can take them out in 3 or 4 weeks, no problem. Yeah, but at what cost?
Sir, you're exactly right in principle, although you're off with just some of your numbers, which, of course, wouldn't be surprising. So it's not 100,000 artillery. The total number is something like 12 or 13,000 artillery. But within that, I've looked at this scenario a little bit. Within that, there really are 1 to 3,000 artillery tubes that we're most worried about. Those are the artillery tubes that the North Koreans have in certain mountain areas where essentially they're in caves. And those artillery pieces are on rail lines in caves so that they can come out, shoot, and then go back in the cave, making it difficult for us to destroy them. You're also right, however, that over 3 or 4 weeks, we are going to destroy them, and we're going to destroy them as they fire. I don't think that the actual casualty estimates, I'm sure, would be classified, but from the artillery, the conventional artillery, we're probably talking somewhere in the neighborhood of many tens of thousands of casualties, which, you're right, is not just simply a bloody nose.
Robert,
it's a serious problem.
Let me ask this question. You said earlier in the broadcast, you made a very strong case on the military superiority of the South. Mm-hmm. Over the North, not even factoring into the United States, although the United States has a treaty that says any attack on South Korea is an attack on the United States.
Exactly right, Chris.
So the full power of the United States would respond to that. But my question to you is, since we at least have discussed here that there's a possibility of this difference of opinion within the North Korean military, mm-hmm. and you have an inexperienced 28-year-old kid who's now running the mm-hmm. country, mm-hmm. Trying to survive because mm-hmm. maybe he wasn't the first choice of the generals.
Yep.
Are there generals that are talking to Kim Jong-un saying what you've just said? Or is there some general saying, hey, you know, we can take them out. Don't worry about it. Forget these numbers. We've got stronger power. And as a 28-year-old kid, is he sophisticated enough to know that his generals, and generals frequently like to blow in the ears of leaders wherever they are, is he painting a much rosier picture of North Korean capability, and could they be leading this despot down the road to make a really stupid decision because in his head he thinks he can take out South Korea? Or as the caller just suggested, hey, I get rid of, you know, 5 or 6 million South Koreans, I'm going to be blown up, but at least I'll be remembered as a guy that got rid of the South Koreans.
The fact of the matter is, Bruce, we don't know, and that's part of the worry. When we say North Korea is a closed society and we don't know much about it, the kind of thing you're asking is exactly one of the things that we're going to know the least amount, even inside of the U.S. government. This is why this scenario, however, is not a surprise. I don't know if you look on the internet, and if your listeners will look on the internet, they'll find that there are South Korean newspaper stories with pictures of Kim Jong-un and his senior military leaders last Friday in his office, in the president of North Korea's office, with maps showing attacks on the United States. Those maps are showing attacks on the United States with the North Korean Air Force. Well, the North Korean Air Force can't do that. It's not physically possible to do that. Now, we would hope that that's there just for propaganda purposes, that it's simply domestic consumption. But,
Craig.
Okay, the bottom line is that over time, the North Koreans have played this game, this threatening game. We are going to threaten you because we want you to feed our people. We want you to give us this, that, and the other thing, all kinds of economic benefit and what have you. Here's the bottom line.
Didn't Bill Clinton give them that?
He did, but
yes.
He didn't.
Yes.
He gave it to them, and nothing happened as a result. They went back to being bellicose again.
Arts here.
Yes, this goes back to 1994 and 95. We agreed to provide them with humanitarian food aid and heavy oil, which they desperately needed.
And they were going to stop the advancement.
They stopped, and then the U.S. House of Representatives, led by the Republicans, and Newt Gingrich was the speaker, they refused to honor Clinton's agreement. It was outrageous. I'm not defending the North Koreans or their ways, but I do think Washington Fun and Games, unfortunately, was principally responsible back then. It's not always the
which
other guy's fault.
Which means that we welched on an important part deal in the 1990s.
Right, right.
So that what Art is saying is important for us to get across, which is there are lots of problems coming from North Korea itself, but the diplomacy and some of our actions have made those problems worse. And what Art has described is a case where we cut a deal and then we took back half of the deal.
Craig.
Well, let's go back to the Army for just a minute. The North Korean Army basically is about 1 million strong, and it has reserves of about 7 million. This compares with about 700,000 in the South Korean Army and about 5 million reservists. But here's the difference. The North Korean military basically does not have armaments to use. They don't have bullets for their weapons. They don't have food to eat with. So that is a huge problem. Their pilots are able to fly perhaps 25 to 30 hours a year in their aircraft. They are not ready for a war, to put it mildly. Now, to get to the missile launchers and missile tubes,
well,
North Korea,
you know, they may not be ready for. We're going to have to break here. They may not be ready for war. That's why it gets back to this iffy situation: is does this young kid who's running that country does he know this? Does he really know? You're painting a very bleak picture of their abilities. Does he really know it? Does he buy it?
Well, their maintenance.
1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We will get back to our discussion of North Korea and South Korea and U.S. Opportunities to deal with that crisis around the world in just a moment after I take a moment to offer my condolences to Chaz Ebert on the loss of her great husband, Roger Ebert. You all have read and heard the stories that television's premier movie critic, Roger Ebert, succumbed to cancer just a few days ago. And again, a good friend personally, and I spent much of the afternoon at the memorial service, one of many memorial services that are being planned here in the Chicagoland area. Again, someone who had an idea to review movies on television. No one had done that before, and along with the late Gene Siskel, they came up with an idea. It caught on. It became iconic, the thumbs up that they would provide to a movie or the thumbs down. It became synonymous with how movies are reviewed, and again, also an integral part of the Chicago media community. And so to Roger Ebert and again to those friends and loved ones who are left behind, most notably Chaz Ebert, who has been his caretaker for many years, over the last 10 years. Much of the last 10 years, she has been focusing on that. And again, our condolences go to her. Let's go back to our discussion now. Let's go to Jim in South Bend, Indiana, listening to us on WMNC. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, boy. With the U.S. military in 138 different countries, DOD.gov, and overstretched, I mean, you know, everybody, you know, the GOP is telling us we're broke. I would refer back to George Washington that said there's two keys to a strong America. Number one, keep strong American borders. And number two, Washington said, stay out of other countries' wars and squabbles. Haven't we learned anything from Iraq, that red herring? And, you know, Eisenhower warned, you know, when the defense contractors pull the strings on let's go to war, we haven't had a good one in 6 or 8 months now. You know, let's go in and invade a country that didn't do anything to us.
But Jim, let me ask you this question, and I'd like our guests to respond first, and then I want to give you an opportunity to offer the last comment.
Yeah.
There is a treaty. Part of this armistice from the 50s was that the United States would protect South Korea. So, Art, is there any question that this is something we have to do?
No, we have to do it. We have about 26,000 troops in South Korea, a lot less than we had during the Cold War. Let me emphasize, because this point is so often made, that we do have a bit of a martyr complex. The South Koreans, except for salaries and pensions and a few other things, they essentially support those troops. We could not have brought the 300,000 back from Germany during the height of the Cold War because we could not have afforded to support them, at least not immediately. That's point number one. Point number two is the ROK Army, the South Korean Army, is quite capable of defending their country. It would be a very bloody war, and we should be prudent. And I believe President Obama and other officials at the administration have been. But I'm quite confident the South Koreans can defend themselves. They maintain 50,000 troops in Vietnam. Throughout our long war, they're almost all combat troops, and as you may know, they had an absolutely ferocious and terrifying reputation mm-hmm. for effectiveness. The enemy in Vietnam went to great, remarkable lengths to avoid the South Koreans. It was just the most brutal and merciless kind of warfare.
We should also put in upon that we have a map that we want to share with the television viewers, and that is that shows where, you know, the difference, you know, where North Korea is, where South Korea is, and where China is. Mm-hmm. And again, the number of troops actually is a little bit higher based on estimates than the figures you gave. It's 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in South Korea. So they were talk about being on the front line of a potential war. So if there was an attack by the North Koreans on Seoul, I mean, many of those 28,500 Americans would be killed.
And these are support troops, by the way. They are not first-line fighting troops.
Right.
But they would not be killed. I'm not sure
not
they're going to be killed.
No, not necessarily.
The border is set up a little differently than it was at the time of 1950. What the South
Wouldn't they be killed in a nuclear attack?
In a nuclear attack, yes. Absolutely. But the spaces are so close together there with the DMZ, many of the North Koreans would also be killed in a nuclear strike. Think of that. If there was a nuclear strike on Seoul.
But your fundamental point is right, Bruce, that there are tens of thousands of U.S. troops in the region, both in South Korea and then in other bases that are vulnerable, Japan and Guam, that are vulnerable to various scenarios. Mm-hmm. Those specific scenarios, we could speculate about them, but your fundamental point is we do have troops that are in harm's way.
Let's go to Phil in listening to us on KTKZ in Sacramento. He's driving along California's highways tonight.
Hi, good evening. I served in the demilitarized zone in the 2nd Infantry Division as a company commander in 67 and 68. And the old man, Kim, was still in charge. And I don't know if you all remember, but there wasn't much of this blustering. He was, he captured the Pueblo. He tried to assassinate Park Chung-hee with a platoon-sized unit. Mm-hmm. And there was squad-sized activity nearly every dark night in the 2nd and 7th Infantry Division zones. And I'd be curious if you could compare and contrast that era when the ROKs did have two divisions in Vietnam to the risk at present. We felt like it was pretty risky then. I'd just like to hear what you have to say.
That's right. That's the 1970s are a period of the crossover point where if you look at the trajectories of the two countries, as I've been describing since the 1950s, it's really the late 60s and 1970s where things fundamentally tip, where from the 1970s on, North Korea is no longer an offensive threat to actually conquer real territory in the South, although they can create harm and they can do things like capture the Pueblo. And that's what you've been seeing.
That was in 1968.
Yeah. Well, my point is that the late
60s... American ship that was captured by the North Vietnam.
My
North
point
Koreans.
Is that that's a reflection of the weakness of North Korea, an increasing weakness, and this is the kind of behavior you get out of weak states.
And the list, go ahead. We are out of time for hour number one of our broadcast this evening, but all of our guests will be back. We're going to continue. We've got a lot of callers on the line. Opportunity for you to call in. 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. If you're listening to the broadcast on radio, keep the calls coming. We'll be continuing this discussion on probably the most important foreign policy issue we have in this country at this very moment. So this is a good opportunity. We've got lots of experience, lots of talent around the table this evening to take your calls. 1-800-723-8289. For watching us on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Art Sear, Craig Capstein, and Robert Pate. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. We've got lots of callers on the line, but we are talking, in case you just tuned in, we are talking about North Korea, the rhetoric that has been spewed for the last several months by their new leader, Kim Jong-un, and also the response that South Korea might offer. And in the first hour, we've talked primarily about the politics and the leadership of North Korea. Let's take a few moments to talk about South Korea. Art, you begin from the Carthage College and A.W. Clausen professor. Tell us a little bit about the new leadership in South Korea and what political pressures is that new leader under?
The new President Park has become unpopular rather quickly. She is the first woman president in Korea. She is the daughter of Park Chung-hee, a very autocratic, to put it mildly, dictator who was assassinated by his head of the Korean CIA, the KCIA, very close to the U.S. CIA, in 1979. I think she symbolizes all that Bob especially was telling us is so positive and productive about Korea. The good news is, and she has been very consistent in contrast to her predecessor, Lee Myung-bak, she's much less rigid. She's much more interested in accommodation with the North. Among the good news is public opinion polls in recent years have shown that Korean, South Koreans, especially young people, don't want a war. They want to avoid any military conflict. They don't want to serve. That has changed dramatically since Pyongyang ruthlessly sank a South Korean corvette 2 years ago, a little over in 2010. Since that time, it's kind of like Britain after Germany invaded Poland in 1939. There's been a tremendous mobilization of patriotism and sentiment that we've got to resist this. One reason she's unpopular is the people in the South wanted to be more belligerent. I'm glad she's not.
But is the when you say the people in the street, many of these South Koreans have grown up with this threat of North Korea. Now they've got this 28-year-old kid. Who's talking loose lips every day, every time he utters words, and he's doing things to provoke. He's the ultimate provocateur. I mean, at some point, don't they want to just get rid of this guy?
I don't think there's a strong sentiment for invading the North. What I'm trying to communicate is one of our callers, the Army veteran, mentioned there's been regular flashes of violence since the Korean War, and in the 60s, things were particularly hot. But sinking... it was so blatant and so aggressive, sinking this South Korean small warships has had a big effect in
Most Americans, I believe, at least listening to the program this evening, believe that North Korea has been viewed as a puppet by the Chinese, and that whatever the Chinese really want, they send the word to the North Koreans, and at least the old man was smart enough to know that you go along with what the Chinese want. Again, we have a new leader now.
Mm-hmm.
Does he know he's supposed to be kowtowing to what China wants, in your view, Craig?
Good question. It depends on what he expects from China, and what he expects from China.
What do they give him?
Well, they've really supplied him with some arms, but they make him pay. They supply him with some food, but again, they make him give back other things as a result of the food.
And obviously not enough food.
But quite frankly, China is the biggest supporter of North Korea, period. All the other supporters of North Korea combined don't equal what China gives, but China does not want a situation backflowing into it. They do not want to have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of refugees coming in if there is a war or something on that order. Going back for just one second.
What about if they started a war, though? I mean, would China not support them?
Just in the last day or 2 days, China has told North Korea to ratchet it down.
Right.
Get that bellicose behavior out of there. It is not worth destroying the entire Pacific region where North Korea is and both Koreas are.
In other words, we're on a roll.
Yeah,
the Chinese say, we're on a roll now. We don't want you to screw it up.
This is a pivotal moment because the Chinese are now telling North Korea to cool it, and the Obama administration is cooling their own rhetoric themselves. So if you look in the last week, the Obama administration has been relatively quiet. I think what the Obama administration and the Chinese are trying to do is get through this next week with no more events. That's why the possibility of a missile launch by North Korea at some point this week could be quite a problem. It's because now you have this. If this were to occur, this would be something that the Obama administration had tried to avoid, but maybe would then feel compelled to respond to.
Will it be? I mean, again, it seems to me, is it just a basic launch, or is it a launch with a warhead? Is it a launch to test whether we have the ability to launch, or is it a test of whether we have the ability to launch something with a nuclear warhead on it that lands somewhere?
Nobody really knows the
answer
to those.
All those possibilities are out there, Bruce. The fact is we have not seen the North Koreans fire a missile at one of our major bases.
Wouldn't we have the ability to knock that down if we're on alert?
We will in probably a few weeks. At the moment, this is exactly the kind of short-range missile air defense that we're moving to the region as we speak. The real concern here is,
but if they do it on Wednesday, it might hit.
We may not be fully in place to stop it.
Art,
as I understand the facts, the speculation is extremely important, and I always learn a lot on your program. But as we know from the facts, first of all, their missile systems are extraordinarily primitive. The tests they've had have been unpredictable. They embarrassed themselves as recently as last April. They abrogated the latest accommodation with Washington. After in February, they'd said they'd start dismantling the nuclear facilities. They launched a missile that exploded. Then more recently, they've had some success. But Guam, in the larger geographic scheme of things, you've got to be really good to hit something as small as Guam. And even if they launch a missile, it might well not hit. We do have, and I have nothing in the way of classified information, we have tremendous capability electronically and photographically to monitor what's going on, and we could take out a missile that was about to be launched.
Let's go to Ron, listening to us in California on POTUS tonight. Go ahead, Ron, you're on the air.
POTUS.
Good evening to all, and thank you for taking my call. As I'm driving, I'm listening to everybody with potential scenarios, and what I think makes the situation even more dire is the fact that these people are mentally unstable, and you really can't predict for that. You can't plan for that, and it puts me on edge because you know, these people that are so removed from the rest of society, I don't know if they even care.
Well, that and, you know, you've touched on sort of what my line of questioning was about 5 minutes ago, and that is, you know, they don't know what they don't know. The new 28-year-old kid that's running the place, he doesn't know what he doesn't know. And so I'm wondering, who is blowing in this guy's ear? Does he have an inflated image of what his military can do? Because if he does, he can create a lot of problems. We do have to pause. Back shortly, 1-800-723-8029. From Shreveport, Louisiana to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. And let's go to Shreveport, where Dan is listening to us on the Big 89 WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Thank you for the interesting program and the history. I was wondering, could you, one of your guests had two questions. One, when was Korea divided between North and South? When did that happen?
When did that happen?
1945.
And how did it happen? Art, give us a little lesson here.
Well, as we discussed earlier on the program, essentially the U.S. and the Soviet Union divided up the country. The Soviets agreed to come in to the Pacific War exactly 3 months after the surrender of Germany, I believe, and they did so. They always kept their specific agreements, Stalin, and that was the background.
And they wanted to split it up for what reason again? I didn't grasp that in your earlier.
They rolled into Manchuria and then they kept rolling into Korea, so it was a de facto.
Russia wanted spoils of war.
We were agreeable to that. They also wanted to occupy part of Japan, and we were emphatic.
Who wants reunification now?
I think.
Does anybody want reunification?
Korean people do.
The North would like it. China would like to see it because they don't want a westernized. All Korea on its border.
Well, the people who count, the Koreans want it. They have a history of unification.
They have a history of about
1,000 years. This is important until the Japanese brutally took over the country in 1905. They were not only unified but largely independent.
The Koreans hate the Japanese, correct?
Yeah.
I think there may be dreams or some aspirations of unification, but I don't think anybody wants to pay any price for unification.
No.
The big issue today is whether unification could come cheaply or expensively, and whether unification comes by war or actually even a lot of the peaceful scenarios. The North is so poor that this is a very expensive.
What communication exists between those families that may be on both sides of the DMZ?
Very little is the answer. It used to be that there was visitation allowed, supervised visitation allowed. But right now, all the modes of communication are shut down. And in fact, if you go back, the Japanese actually occupied Korea in 1905, in 1905, Japan closed Korea to the outside world. It wasn't reopened until 1945. In that interim, Japan made Koreans take Japanese names and abolished the speaking of the Korean language, allowing only Japanese.
It was particularly harsh from 1905. But Japan is unpopular throughout Asia, in my experience, except Taiwan.
I want to get back to what the military options are, because what we have heard, at least in some reports, is that there are these pictures of Kim Jong-un, before the maps, talking about, targets, excuse me, in the United States. You're saying that they don't have the capability to do that.
Not with their Air Force, and their missiles can't reach the United States. We do worry about their military capability in the region.
No.
If we talk about threats directly to the United States, then we're talking about scenarios that have to do with terrorism or commando raids or very, essentially professional covert action.
Possible
how aggressive are they? How aggressive are the North Koreans in exporting terrorism?
Well, what you haven't seen is North Koreans take steps where they would have to pay heavy costs. They're already under economic sanctions. So when they do things like try to export missiles, they really don't have much to lose. The steps that you don't see them taking are things that would compel us to retaliate in a major way. So as erratic as the North Korean regime has been, as much as we fear they may act suicidally, notice how for 60 years, they haven't acted suicidally.
Yeah, South Korea has been pacifistic in its response, basically. When they had their corvette sunk with a loss of about 50 lives, they basically did nothing.
You see, we are right at the moment where we could escalate the conflict. The conflict could escalate, or it could blow over. If the conflict blows over, I think that that would be an opportunity to try to fundamentally shift tracks with North Korea. And it might be that China would work with us on this, because for the last 20 years, we have tried to squeeze North Korea increasingly. And the fact is, it's not working. It's making North Korea more belligerent.
But didn't North Korea provide the know-how for Pakistan to go nuclear?
Oh, AQ. No, this is coming.
Not really.
Not really. That's
the other way around.
The other way around.
Okay.
The AQCON network is helping North Korea.
Yeah, it's not. Helped.
Khan helped North
Korea.
Who are the other?
We've talked about China. Who are the other supporters of North Korea who are doing business with them, who are not abiding by sanctions that that the United States has imposed in other Western nations?
Iran, other countries in the Middle East, some of the former Stan countries, even Afghanistan was for a while.
They are a principal supplier.
Pakistan.
They are a principal supplier of black market merchandise. Our Justice Department has provided a lot of details. This is some actual facts that we know. So whether it's nuclear components, and they did work with Syria, Bruce. The Israelis took out a Syria-North Korea installation. I'm sure we were involved. Women, drugs, counterfeit money, weapons of all kinds, liquor, you name it. If it's ugly and criminal, they're trying desperately to get hard currency, and that implies the former Soviet Union.
Are they the most criminal? Because you've just described a long list of criminal activity.
Iran is.
I was just going to say, Iran is more
Korea,
criminal than
no, I don't.
North
I don't
Korea?
Think so.
In terms of destabilization of other regimes, in terms of export of armament.
Yes. I'm talking about pure
terrorism.
I'm talking about human trafficking. I'm talking about drugs and everything else.
Well, those are pretty puritanical. They give aid to Afghanistan partly because they're upset about the poppy traffic and trade from Afghanistan.
Let's go to
they
Dennis in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, listening to us on WAPI. Nice to hear from the Deep South tonight. Go ahead. Dennis, are you there? I guess Dennis is gone. Well, let's head to the Pacific coast, and let's go to David listening to us on the Internet from San Francisco. Go ahead.
Hey, greetings, Bruce, and your guest. You know, I was interested in land issues as it regards Korea. When you look at a couple of different issues regarding pollution recently, the air pollution that, of course, we're getting here on the West Coast from China is hitting us, so it's got to be hitting Korea first. And it must be damaging their agricultural land, so I'm wondering what kind of factor that has. And then, as I understand it, with Fukushima, a lot of the Japanese are kind of scurrying around to find better living arrangements because of the tainted land in the northern section of the islands there. So it's causing some land rifts between China and Japan, and I'm wondering if that's also causing population shifts, and those population shifts are stirring up this issue.
Whether that's happening or not, pollution is actually an excellent opportunity to fundamentally reshape relations with North Korea. As I was saying earlier, we're right at the moment here where we've seen now for 20 years this policy of increasingly trying to crush this country is not working, and it's creating more problems than it's solving. How do we change it? How do we change this? Well, we have to do it in a way that saves face for everybody involved. Bruce, that's what you're asking for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one way to do it is to say, you know, we have this common problem. It's called pollution. Why don't we actually establish a set of economic measures that could be I suppose, sold as defeating the problem or tackling the problem of pollution, but then fundamentally are about essentially providing massive consumer products to 20 million people who are on the verge of starvation.
And there is
a couple of weeks ago when Dennis Rodman went and was with Kim Jong-un. All right, everybody laughed at it, okay? When he did his interviews, when Dennis Rodman did his interviews, he said that all that Kim Jong-un wanted was a phone call from President Obama. And all the diplomats and everybody on the show said that would never, ever happen. There's a lot of people that may be listening to the program this evening that would say, why not? What's so bad about President Obama calling Kim Jong-un to find out what's on his mind? Art's here.
I think it would be a very bad idea.
Why?
Dennis Rodman is a fool. He's being used by Pyongyang. We would only be reinforcing foolish behavior, not only by a celebrity who's going downhill fast.
Is that a simple?
And will suffer, considerably.
Is that a simple request? I'm talking about.
No.
I'm talking about the average Americans. Many would say, what's wrong with that? Pick up the phone. Don't make a big deal of it. Make it a private call. You pick him up, you know.
It wouldn't stay private.
Does he speak English?
Wouldn't stay private, Bruce. It would become public very
quickly.
Okay,
and it would be propaganda used against the United States that we would look weak by picking up the phone and talking to this guy.
Well, if I were a lawyer, the Logan Act, which has been around since shortly after the Revolution, prohibits and imposes criminal penalties on American private citizens who try to conduct diplomacy. I actually think Mr. Rodman ought to be prosecuted under the Logan Act. But I may be a little far out on that.
But I think Art is right if it's in direct response to some celebrity issue. I think that Art is absolutely right. But that doesn't mean there aren't other ways to move in this direction. So in the past, we have sent former administration officials to try to meet with North Korean leaders.
Well, Jimmy Carter met with. Didn't Jimmy Carter?
No,
didn't
Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton got a couple.
Didn't he send Jimmy Carter over there to work on this?
And my point is that I think Art is absolutely right under those circumstances, but the key thing, I think, is there was an opportunity there to be a bit creative, and that's the opportunity that the ball was dropped.
What you're saying
we have to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Art Sear wants to prosecute Dennis Rodman for a violation of the Logan Act. What do you think of that? Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago around the table this evening. Craig Capstein is here. He is a captain in the United States Naval Reserve, retired. 28 years of worldwide service with the United States Navy in the Reserve, served in Operations Desert Storm, and also served in the Navy Special Warfare Group, attached to a SEAL 1 group, although he was not a U.S. SEAL. And again, he served in Korea as well throughout his career. And also, one of the things that you do, Craig, is you lead tours. You're in the travel business, and you lead tours to places around the world. And before I introduce the rest of the guests, I want to ask you about one piece of the story about what's happening in North Korea. And that is, although the North Koreans are telling and giving warnings to embassies and consulates that maybe you should move your people out, suggesting that, you know, they're certainly raising the level of a possible some sort of action of some sort. There was a report that the person who leads group tours to North Korea, who works with a North Korean travel emissary or commission, they are not telling people to stop touring North Korea. Now, are they just trying to suck all these tourists in and then maybe they're going to get zapped when they go there? Or is this sort of the commercial side of North Korea saying, we want the tourists to keep coming. We're going to scare the hell out of the diplomats and tell them that we're going to, you know, that look out. But in reality, they're not being consistent because they want tourists to come there.
Well, communications is a real key issue. And so we don't know whether or not the newest Kim and his military are talking with the person that does the leading of tours. I used to do tours all over the world. In fact, I've been in 113 countries. I used to take our travelers to our United States embassies around the world until it became too dangerous. When you see sandbag revetments around the embassies and the embassy people tell you it's getting to be very tenuous, don't
bad
bring people
tourism.
Here anymore. You really want to showcase what our heroes that belong to the State Department and other U.S. departments do, but you can't get into many of the embassies right now. I would say that probably the person in North Korea has got some inside track, some knowledge that even the military may not have. Communications in North Korea, only the NSA can tell you what's really going on.
By the way, you mentioned about the diplomats and the young diplomats. I mean, we would be remiss if we didn't say
woman.
A word tonight about Anne Smegelhoff, a 25-year-old member of the U.S. Diplomatic Corps, who was killed along with other U.S. servicemen in Afghanistan today. She hailed from River Forest, Illinois, which is not far from where you live, Robert Pape, in Oak Park. And she was killed and shot down, and Secretary of State John Kerry she was part of his briefing team on a recent visit to Afghanistan. And again, all she was doing was delivering school books. She wanted to deliver school books to students in Afghanistan so they could learn. And she, along with other servicemen, three servicemen and one defense contractor, they were killed by, Secretary of State Kerry referenced, cowardly terrorists. So again, our condolences to the family living just within the sound of our voice here in Chicago. Art Sear, the A.W. Clawson Professor of Carthage College, also joins us this evening, author of the book After the Cold War. Another one of our authors this evening has written Bombing to Win. He is Robert Pape. He is with the University of Chicago. He's one of the country's foremost experts on air power and military power. And again, a lot of experience around the table this evening. And we're going to go to calls in just a moment after I mention something that's coming up at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. And it is next Saturday night, and it's next Sunday afternoon before we go on the air. This is a unique opportunity for you to come to see a television situation comedy in its final stages of development. There's going to be, they call it a table read. There's going to be a read of a sitcom. They want to test the audience reaction to that sitcom. And here are some of the people who are going to be here next Saturday and next Sunday at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. The name of the new show is I've Got a Gal in Kalamazoo. It is a pilot. It's not yet been sold. But this is an opportunity for you to sort of get in involved in early on weighing in on whether or not there's a successful sitcom on the horizon. Vicki Lewis, who is one of the stars of News Radio and Finding Nemo, and of course she was on Broadway in Chicago, she's one of the stars. But here are also classic television personalities. Ed Asner, 7 Emmys, 5 Golden Globes. Ed Asner, one of the true icons of American television, will be here, as well as Marion Ross. From Happy Days and Brothers and Sisters, and Gregory Jabara, who's currently on Blue Bloods on CBS with Tom Selleck and was the Tony Award-winning actor in the Broadway play Billy Elliot. So we've got some great actors and actresses coming to the Museum of Broadcast Communications. If you want to come to tickets, you can go to museum.tv. It is a benefit, but again, it's something that you're not going to have an opportunity to see very often. And you go to museum.tv, Ed Asner, Marion Ross, Vicki Lewis, Greg Jabara, all under the same roof at the Museum of Broadcast Communications next Saturday night, and then there will be a matinee on Sunday afternoon. Let's go to Dennis, listening to us in Tuscaloosa. We missed him the last time we went there, but he's standing by now, listening to a great radio station, WAPI. Go ahead, Dennis.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me. I just have two quick questions. I'll throw them back out there, and then I'll listen. Number one, if South Korea is so strong and capable of handling their own defense, why have we not been drawing down our presence there for the last 10 years to zero? And number two...
Let's answer that one first one. It's a good question. Robert Pate.
Okay. Because they're in South Korea, not only because of North Korea. There has been a lot of concern that China and Japan could end up having security problems between themselves. And this has been going on for many, many decades. Well, one of the purposes of American troops in Asia and in Japan and in South Korea is to serve as sort of a pacifier, if you would, on relations between China and Japan. And Japan, China is a nuclear state. Japan is not. So one of the things we worry is that if we truly withdrew our military troops from Asia, that Japan might go nuclear. So this is it's complicated because they're in part because of North Korea, but truly that mission is really a mission that's completely changed. To the extent they're actually having an effect on North Korea, it would be with training South Korean troops, as Craig said.
A question: we know that an attack on South Korea is viewed as an attack on the United States under the armistice of the Korean conflict.
Mm-hmm.
What obligations do we have if someone attacks Japan?
Regardless of the technical diplomatic obligations, the fact is South Korea and Japan have been our allies for many, many decades, and we've stationed troops in their country. So if there was an attack pretty much by anybody against South Korea and Japan, Bruce, there would be pressure, pressure on any president to respond in some way to that attack.
But there's no treaty that
there
says
is. There is a security treaty.
All right, that's what I want to clarify.
Excuse me, John Foster Dulles, as an emissary of the Truman administration, as part of his long-term campaign, successful to be Secretary of State, negotiated that along with a peace treaty with Japan in 52, I believe, right, Bob?
I think Art is exactly right on the technicalities of the treaty, but my point, Bruce, is that treaty was ripped up tomorrow, the fact is these are long-standing allies of the United States with troops where American troops have been stationed on their soil.
Dennis, your next question.
Just in regards to the HUCON network that was mentioned earlier, is there anyone on the panel that has any tangible reason to be concerned about the possibility of sleeper cells or knowledge that came from that temporary time when HUCON was out and about that might threaten the United States in that way?
I think that we don't I don't have any specific knowledge about this, but I think there's good reason to the issue with sleeper cells isn't so much whether there's somebody who's sympathetic to an evil regime or a regime that hates the United States somehow working in the United States. The question is, what material would they have to harm us with? And one of the things I'm very confident in is that American intelligence has spent a lot of time trying to track all the really bad material in North Korea, the fissile material, the chemical, not just chemical weapons, but the precursors to chemical weapons and also biological weapons. And so I think that we would really, I think I'm very skeptical that those materials have somehow leaked into the United
States. But we now
have
electronic warfare as well to be concerned about. True. North Korea does not have to move out of its own geographic region to
I would think, though, on the area of terrorism, and again, this is I would hope that there's somebody in North Korea that is sane somewhere in some position of authority. But it seems to me that if North Korea were to engage in an act of terrorism, domestic terrorism or terrorism within the United States, the reaction would be overwhelming against them as it was against Afghanistan. So they would lose in that respect. And if they're going to roll the dice and sort of gamble what they can get away with, it seems to me that they probably would say, hey, we can do this. Let's just lob some into Seoul. And they could do a hell of a lot more damage and suffer the same consequences.
Yes, national suicide.
Right.
They would be destroyed.
I don't think that'll happen. But I think they'll get better and better at electronic warfare. And they just launched electronic warfare operations against the South in the last 2 weeks and shut down a number of the banks in Seoul.
I want to talk more about that, talk about cyber attacks. And certainly we know that China's knee-deep in that. We'll talk about more about what North Korea might be up to and South Korea and a lot of other nations of the world, what the cyber wars look like. We do have calls coming in from Korea, about Korea rather, not from Korea, certainly not from North Korea. 1-800-723-8029. That's the way I used to say the phone number, but now I say it 1-800-723-8029. 723-8289. Bruce Dumont, thank you very much for joining us this evening. The phone number, 1-800-723-8289, 723-8289. And for those people who've written me and emailed me saying that I talk too fast and I've got to give the phone number the new way, it's going to take me, I've been doing this for 30 years this way, folks, so it may take a few weeks to get reacclimated, but 1-800-723-8289. And let's go to Stockton, California, where John is listening to us on KGOE. Go ahead, John.
Thank you for taking my call. I was going to say, in the movie Die Another Day, they have a young leader that's just as crazy as Kim Jong-un in the movie, and his goal is to invade the South across the DMZ, which he does with, you know, Icarus is some kind of a solo thing that knocks out all the mines in there. But in reality, he does have that atom bomb. So for the North, I would say that they would have a good odds of just invading. Even if they lost, they'd be rebuilt by the United States after the war. But they have a, you know, a puncher's chance of actually conquering the South if they sent everybody at once in a massive attack on the South.
Well, we've got people.
We've
got people around the table. You probably can't hear them shaking their heads, but Robert Pate wants to challenge your premise.
Well, so just a couple of technicalities. The big issue is our air power advantage. So, and the South Koreans would also have the same advantage, which is that the terrain on the Korean Peninsula is extremely mountainous, which means any attacks are going to go through very well-known channeled areas, which are just perfect for our sensors to pick up and our precision air power to destroy. So any attack by the North, even if they took all million men and tried to flood the North at one time, they're going to go through these pretty narrow mountain passes. We have an air power advantage that simply won't be trumped, even if all the other local advantages somehow were.
And Craig, you have more specifics about this, the terrain and the difference between fighting an offensive war and fighting a defensive war. This is very difficult terrain, as anyone who was involved in the Korean conflict knows.
Well, what we were talking about during the break is that there are many, many exits to go north or to go south from north-south or south-north. One of the lessons learned and one of the things that's constantly demonstrated during the exercises, these large multi-nation exercises or the exercises with the U.S. and North Korea or South Koreans, is the fact that all these exit points can be blocked almost at will, and they can be blocked electronically. You can drop huge things that look like bridges right now. They could be 20 feet high, 20 feet across, solid concrete. Tanks can't get through them. And then if you can't get a tank through there, your tank becomes useless. It becomes a great target for your air power, your superior air power. The only time a tank can get through on a different track would be to go in the dead of winter when rice paddies are frozen. Otherwise, that tank is going to get mired down in rice paddies. So the problem is the North may have all kinds of armor and everything else. I also question the maintenance of the armor. If there's no money to buy bullets for the troops to even try firing and qualifying at a range, there's no money to really fight a war.
Let's go to Bloomington, Illinois. Bob is listening to us on WLS Radio. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, hi. I believe that North Korea is acting under the guise of China. In other words, they are a surrogate. And this is actually China using North Korea to do their dirty work. And right now, with their attempts to look at our defenses as we try to protect Guam with anti-missile defense, try to build up our defenses perhaps in South Korea, Japan, China is watching, maybe tapping into our communication codes with our submarines, with our ships, etc., maybe even trying to jam as they have done before. And China has a history of using private companies as surrogates to tap into the Pentagon and try to get into the internet system, the banking system, etc. So I think that North Korea, everything they're doing is with the tacit approval of China.
Art Sears got some comments for you, Bob.
Sure. Well,
the caller's right in that the Obama administration, one of Secretary of Defense Gates' last acts was to reemphasize Asia and make our European allies nervous, I think for political reasons, by this strategic shift, as it's been described, towards Asia. That's in direct response to this enormous strategic buildup by China. However, and it's an important but, China historically and currently is extremely cautious about using their military force in provocative ways. The People's Army only intervened in Korea around Thanksgiving 1950 when MacArthur made these bombastic threats that we've talked about, and when he moved up to the Yalu River, the Chinese were consistent in saying if we did that, they would have to come in. They put up with well over a half a million American and other allied troops, to say nothing of the large South Vietnamese army, for many years without intervening. I do think that historically the Chinese have been extremely cautious.
We have less than a minute left, actually about 15 seconds for everybody. As an American, what should we be fearing? What should we fear about this experience? Actually, 10 seconds each. Robert?
That we'll overreact.
Art Sear.
Fear itself. South Korea is a wonderful success story for us as well as them.
That one mistake, Greg, could lead to war on the Korean Peninsula. A mistake by either side.
Okay. On that note, we are out of time for our broadcast. Art Sear and Craig Capstein and Robert Pape all join us this evening. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bruce.
This is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. We will be back next Sunday night live from Chicago. We hope that you can join us. Until then, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.